Now Alex Jennings continues reading Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure by Tim Jeale. Dr. David Livingstone spent 10 frustrating years as a medical missionary in Botswana. Then, between 1853 and 1856, he crossed Africa from coast to coast along the line of the Zambezi. John Speke's and Richard Burton's rival Nile theories gripped his imagination. Samuel Baker had found Lake Albert on the Nile, which seemed to support but not prove Speke's case. But now, Livingstone has decided on another African journey, starting far to the south of Lake Victoria.
David Livingstone was in his 53rd year on the 19th of March 1866 when he landed on the East African coast and plunged inland into thick jungle. He was followed by 35 porters and a bizarre assortment of baggage animals consisting of 4 buffaloes, 6 camels, 4 donkeys and 6 mules. The day was fiercely hot, and Dr. Livingstone and his polyglot following of coastal Africans, Indian sepoys and mission-educated freed slaves were soon struggling along a valley choked with rank grass that towered above their heads and made them feel as if they were being smothered. Although he joked about his smile as being that of a hippopotamus and himself as a dreadful old fogey, he was physically fit for his age and was convinced that he could achieve his astonishingly ambitious twin aims of solving the Nile mystery and shaming the British government into suppressing the Arab-Swahili slave trade. As he and his men left the coastal belt of jungle, he felt all the old exhilaration.
The mere animal pleasure of travelling in a wild, unexplored country is very great. Africa is a wonderful country for appetite.
His optimism did not last long. His porters dawdled, stole, and threatened to desert. On the 6th of August 1866, when he reached the blue waters of Lake Nyasa, he found a dash in the breakers quite exhilarating. By now, he was down to 23 men, less than half the number he had had in early May. In the following November, he heard that an immense river flowed out of Lake Mweru's northwestern corner about 600 miles away. This river, at the very heart of Africa, was called the Lualaba, and from the moment Livingstone heard its name, he knew that he would have to follow it in case it proved to be the source of the Nile. Eventually, after much illness and enforced rest, he entered in his journal, "With only 3 attendants, Susi, Chuma and Gardner, I started off to the northwest for the Lualaba." It was the rainy season, and the path he was on resembled a small river. A species of palm with long, thick leaf stalks had colonized the valley he now entered, obliging him to follow a track created by elephant and buffalo. In consequence, he and his men often fell into elephants' footprints up to their thighs. Malaria had prostrated him many times, but now he was more worried about his worsening bowel and digestive problems. Many of his molars were so loose that he was obliged to perform extractions, employing a strong thread with what sailors call a clove hitch, and then striking the thread with a heavy pistol. In mid-July, he wrote despairingly in his journal,
"For the first time in my life, my feet failed me. Instead of healing quietly as heretofore, when torn by hard travel, irritable eating ulcers fastened on both feet."
Having only 3 attendants, Livingstone knew there was no question of his being carried, so he had no choice but to limp back to the nearest significant Manyema town, numb with misery at his failure to reach the river. For 7 frustrating months, Livingstone was unable to move any closer to the fabled river. Though remarkably patient with villagers who stared, he drew the line when locals came and pushed off the door of my hut with a stick while I was resting, as we should do with a wild beast in a cage. Occasionally, moments of pure comedy delighted him, as when he washed his hair and the watching audience fled, having mistaken the soapy lather for his brains being taken out for a wash. By October, Livingstone's ulcers were starting to heal, and he was able to leave his hut. He left for the Lualaba on the 16th of February, 1871.
The grass and mud are grievous, but my men lift me over the waters. The country is everywhere beautiful and undulating. Light green grass covers it all, save at the brooks.
In March, he was awed by his first sight of the broad brown waters of the Lualaba, 3,000 yards wide at this point, flowing slowly and powerfully northwards between densely forested banks. This river appeared on no maps, and so its discovery was all the more thrilling. During the next 3 days, he made numerous attempts to buy canoes from local people in order to continue his exploration of the river, but without success. Then, on the 15th of July, Livingstone witnessed the massacre of over 400 African residents of Nyangwe by Arab Swahilis, some shot down in the marketplace, and others drowned in a nearby creek in their panic to escape. He was so distressed by this that his will to continue down the river collapsed. He could no longer bring himself to beg Arabs to sell him the canoes he so desperately needed. He turned his back on the river, and in deep depression began the 200-mile march to the east to his base, Ujiji, on Lake Tanganyika. Livingstone reached Ujiji on the 23rd of October,
now reduced to a skeleton.
All he had left with which to buy food was a few yards of calico. There seemed no realistic hope now that he would be able to pay for the milch goats, wheaten flour, and fish needed for his recovery. Less than a week later, a young Welshman, masquerading as an American, was camped on a hillside a few miles from Ujiji, gazing down,
as in a painted picture, at the vast lake, set in a frame of dimly blue mountains.
Henry Morton Stanley, traveller, would-be explorer and war reporter, had managed to persuade the editor and owner of the New York Herald, for which he worked, to send him to find the missing Livingstone, the reporting of which, Stanley hoped, would make him famous. After a hair-raising journey lasting 10 months, he entered Ujiji on the 10th of November, 1871. An animated crowd surged around the advancing newcomers, and Susi, one of Livingstone's longest-serving followers, greeted Stanley ecstatically and then ran off, shouting,
"An Englishman coming! I see him!"
At the point in Stanley's diary where he advances towards Livingstone, 3 pages have been torn out, just where he ought to be saying,
"Dr. Livingstone, I presume."
The only reason for tearing them out would seem to be because they had not confirmed the words of the famous greeting, nor is the historic question to be found anywhere in Livingstone's writings. The greeting would appear to have been invented by Stanley at some point during the 6 months that followed the meeting. But whatever was said, there can be no doubt at all that Livingstone had never been so pleased to see a white face as he was to see Stanley's. He was not exaggerating when he said,
"You have brought me new life."
Just 4 days after the younger man's arrival, Livingstone suggested that he travel with him to the Lualaba to help him finish his work. Stanley proposed a compromise. They should travel instead to the infinitely more accessible northern end of Lake Tanganyika. Stanley had been aware since 1865 of Burton's claim that the River Rusizi flowed northwards out of Lake Tanganyika into the southern end of Baker's Lake Albert before continuing northwards as the White Nile. Stanley and Livingstone embarked on the 16th of November. 12 days later, they reached the head of the lake and found that the Rusizi River flowed into the northern end of Lake Tanganyika rather than out of it. This was a major discovery, and at a stroke ruled out Lake Tanganyika as being any kind of source or reservoir of the Nile. It seemed that either the Victoria Nyanza or the Lualaba's headwaters were now the only serious candidates for being the Nile's source. Having grown so fond of his father figure, Stanley did his best to persuade him to come home with him before returning to the Lualaba. But Livingstone was determined to stick it out for another 18 months in Africa to sort out the Nile's watershed. Before he left for England, Stanley chose for David Livingstone 56 men to be sent from Zanzibar. He equipped each man with a musket and ammunition, and also provided flour, sugar, coffee, tea, numerous varieties of tinned food, hundreds of yards of cloth, and 2 riding donkeys. These arrived with Livingstone 6 months later. Livingstone's aim was to reach the southern foot of Lake Tanganyika, then march round Lake Bangweulu, the Lualaba source 150 miles to the south, about 1,000 miles in all, and finally navigate the Lualaba northwards. On the 25th of August, 1872, he started towards Lake Tanganyika. It was blisteringly hot, and his porters became exhausted, their feet burned by the soil. Livingstone himself was ill with fever and with dysentery by mid-October. His health worsened when the rains came, and he soon became too weak to ford rivers and streams. On the 10th of April, Livingstone at last admitted the gravity of his position.
"I am pale, bloodless and weak from bleeding profusely ever since the 31st of March last."
He was now south of Bangweulu and travelling in a broad arc around the lake's southern shore. Although excessively weak and unable to walk, he managed to ride his last surviving donkey for an hour and a half. That evening he wrote a sublime understatement.
"It is not all pleasure, this exploration."
The last entry in his diary was written on the 27th of April.
"Knocked up quite."
Amazingly, on the 29th, he told his men to dismantle his hut so that the litter could be brought right up to his bed. He could not have walked to the door of the hut, and yet, while life remained, was determined to continue his search for the sources. They were now 70 miles south of Bangweulu. This was journey's end, and here his followers built a hut and raised his grass and sacking bed from the floor on a frame of sticks, placing his medicine chest on a packing case by his bed. Livingstone dozed through much of the 30th, but that evening the Nile still dominated his thoughts.
"Is this the Luapula?"
he asked Susi suddenly. Susi told him that they were still 3 days from the Luapula, the river which flows into the Lualaba.
"Oh, dear, dear,"
he sighed, and then fell asleep. He died a few hours later. He was found by Susi, half-dressed and kneeling on his bed, with his head resting on the pillow. It looked as though he was praying. Few, if any, of Livingstone's followers would have understood why he had risked his life, and indeed sacrificed it, in a vain attempt to establish the relationship of widely separated rivers and lakes to the distant River Nile. But his men knew extraordinary courage and determination when they saw it, and respected him as a great man. Stanley heard of Livingstone's death during his voyage back to England from West Africa. Although he grieved, he was stirred by the thought of finishing the work of his hero, with its powerful images of self-sacrifice and devotion to duty.
"The completion of your father's discoveries,"
he told Livingstone's daughter Alice,
"is a legacy left to me by him."
And tomorrow, Alex Jennings reads the final episode of Explorers of the Nile, The Triumph and Tragedy of a Great Victorian Adventure by Tim Gill. It was abridged by Libby Spurrier, produced by Joanna Green, and it was a peer production for the BBC. Jane Gardam is a multi-award-winning English writer, and though in her 40s when she published her first book in 1971, is one of the most prolific novelists of her generation. Next week on 4 Extra, we have a selection from her most recently published volume of short stories, including on Tuesday, Stone Trees, in which a grieving widow recalls the complicated life she shared with her recently departed husband.
"Terrible party. Jesus College. Anna met Tom, and I met you, my darling, and it was something or other. Feminism, Neoplatonism, Third World. And there you were with bright, ridiculous, marvellous, mocking eyes and long, hard hands. And I loved you as everyone else clearly loved you."
Sylvester Latuzel reads Stone Trees, one of 5 Jane Gardam stories, starting next Monday morning at 11 and again in the evening at 9.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock and time for drama with our play Judith Shakespeare. Then Mel Gedroych hears about the joy of beekeeping and Jamie Oliver explains his passion for food in the 4 o'clock show. Our play later is a quirky comedy about a teenager who becomes an internet phenomenon. Joshua Jenkins is the boy and Julia McKenzie plays his rather suspicious grandmother who decides to put a stop to his broadcasts. Tiny, tonight at 9:15. Our play now is set in the early 17th century. It's the story of William Shakespeare's younger daughter. A loner, at odds with the confined world of Stratford-upon-Avon, Judith yearns to be a part of her father's life.
Judith Shakespeare by Nan Woodhouse, with Amanda Root as Judith and Michael Pennington as William. Stratford-upon-Avon, beginning of the 17th century.
My father to Susanna and Dr. John for supper. I to the river then, into mingy mist, talking to who? Cracked, Judith, poor at making friends. To myself talk. Alone here, treading the hard path. You won't know where I am. To Susanna and Doctor. A good marriage. Pleasing to mother, and more than pleasing to father. A gentleman with his own coat of arms. Actor, drama crafter, shareholder. Making his name in the great city. Making good money for Stratford tithes. Gathering much to pass on to the man who will carry on the Shakespeare line. As yet, Susanna has no such son, and Judith no prospect. You are happiest with Susanna. So alike. Not as alike as Hamlet and I. Not twins, body and spirit. I am torn from my shadow. From he who is nearer than my mother's breast. You thrust me from you then, when Hamlet died. Why? Would you, father, had rather have my death than that of my brother? River moves sluggardly, scums with weed, scarce breathes. This day, this night, a body fallen in would drop like a stone. Simple. The end of it.
Judith! Judith! Judith!
I hear you. I hear you, Hamlet. Oh, I look for you still. Along this path together. Dancing we shared a thought coloured as a bubble. It grew, shimmered, it contained us. Then it shattered. The morning you died, the light was queer, and the world still. The wise woman, come to do her grim task, called me from sleep.
Get up, Judith! Judith, get up!
And I thought, my mother has gone, there's a stranger in the house. Then I knew it was not my mother, for I tried to obey the call.
Judith, get up!
And my legs would not move. They move now. To run is to forget, to spin out the poison. But I should go back, go home and await their return. Speak with father in the same low voice he loves in Susanna, and go to my bed blessed with peace. Peace, father, is not to be found so easy. A low voice, a gentle hand, a pleasant wit. There is a wilderness to traverse before I can show you these.
I am thinking only of you.
No, father.
I shall not live forever.
I can take care of myself.
There should be no need.
I am 24 years old.
Oh, you do not behave so.
I cannot do right for you.
You need...
What?